This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Good morning. It is time for this week's broadcast of Worcester Magazine, your local connection to the news, views, and events happening in Worcester. Today, we will be reading from the July 17th, 2026 edition of Worcester Magazine. This program is brought to you in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind. I'm Julie Standrovich, reading with Catherine Thornton. Thank you for joining us, and we begin, as usual, with Wisteria. Three Decker offers poetic views from the roof, written by Margaret Smith. On a summer's evening, a gathering fills the main hall at Salisbury House to do what anyone would naturally do as the July sun begins to set. Listen to poetry along with live music. The poems ran the gamut of expression from sorrowful, surreal, and searching for connections in a world that doesn't always seem to offer any, and where they must sometimes be forged, poem by poem. Keyboardist David Leach provided accompanying tunes with improvisation and a measure of sound and silence. The occasion was the release of the new issue of Three Decker, a literary journal published by Worcester County Poetry Association, with an eye toward uplifting poets with ties to Worcester County. Full disclosure, one of the poets in the issue is myself. Poets in this issue include many whose names will ring familiar to anyone in the area's poetry circles, including Catherine Brooke, Fadi Youssef, Tom Gorman, Amber Johns, and Mimi Das. Worcester County Poetry Association board members Irene Akasi, Robert Baker, and Catherine Gregoire comprise the publication's editorial board. Three Decker originated with Baker and Tariq Cooper, a fellow board member of the association. Akasi noted the WCPA used to have a secondary publication in the 90s that was very Worcester County focused, known as The Issue. Rob and Tariq wanted to rebrand and bring back the issue so as to showcase and promote Worcester County writers and capture the literary zeitgeist of our time and place. Baker and Cooper connected with the City of Worcester's Cultural Development Office and its Poet Laureate program through director Fabian Barracks. This resulted in a partnership with the city to support the first two issues of Three Decker, with the promise that the association would publish a few Poet Laureate and Youth Poet Laureate poems in those two issues. We officially launched in 2025, and we printed the first two issues of Three Decker, Summer and Winter, said Akasi. Each issue runs on average 200 to 250 copies. Akasi said, "It is new and growing, and we are very much hoping to grow that number." Three Decker's origins also lie within a need the association saw, said Akasi. The WCPA was lacking a place for local poets and writers to be recognized and published. The Worcester Review is proudly one of the more prestigious literary journals in the country. But because of that reputation and mission, it wasn't designed as a vehicle for the voices of Worcester County. Akasi added, "We really wanted something that would connect with here and now. Being writers and poets ourselves, we really saw the potential in doing something for and with the writers and poets in our own neighborhood." Three Decker is $15 per copy. To order, visit threedecker.org. The Worcester County Poetry Association will present the Stanley Kunitz Poetry Medal to poet and educator Susan Elizabeth Sweeney, the 12th recipient of the medal, in a ceremony set for 6:30 p.m. July 23rd at the Museum of Worcester. The Stanley Kunitz Medal, named for poet and Worcester native Stanley Kunitz, is presented each year by the association to a poet with strong links to Worcester County and who exemplifies Kunitz's lifelong commitment to poetry by teaching and mentoring poets, publishing poetry, and strengthening the role of poetry in the region. The Stanley Kunitz Medal originated with a bequest to the Worcester County Poetry Association from the poet's estate. The first recipient was the late poet, activist, and Assumption University professor Michael D. True in 2015. To learn more, visit WorcesterCountyPoetry.org. All right, that concludes Wisteria. Now we're moving on to a first-person article by Joe Fusco Jr., and this one is titled, Joe Fusco Jr. Makes Herculean Effort at 4th of July Fest. My daughter Amanda and her husband Rich just bought their first home in Holden. My wife Cindy and I usually host the family 4th of July party because we have an above-ground pool, but it was 90 degrees this year, and the Dotties, the surname of Fusco's daughter and son-in-law, Newhouse, has central air. So when they volunteered to host the party, I readily agreed. There was a caveat. There were outdoor games to be played before dinner. The Dottie Olympics had three teams of four people. I was grouped with my daughter, Heather, her husband, Anthony, and my granddaughter's boyfriend, Jarek. I mentioned that our team should be given handicap points because I was the oldest contestant and, well, handicapped, but the judges voted it down. The first event was a watermelon eating contest. Why my daughter Heather was our team blue representative is a mystery for the ages. Bless her competitive spirit, but she was only halfway through when Rich from Team Green was gnawing on his rind. No points. For the next contest, each group was given items like paper mache, ribbons, cardboard, and silly string to dress a member up as the Statue of Liberty. Jarek bravely volunteered and looked positively liberating, but social media voted for my 10-year-old granddaughter, Ashlyn, from Team Orange. No points. The third event was a water balloon tossing contest. I wish Cindy and I were teammates because 25 years ago, at a dude ranch in the Catskills, we had a water balloon that took a lickin' but kept on tickin', despite my wife's numerous drops and errant throws, and won us the camp gold. It stayed intact in the sink of our cabin for another 6 days, rivaling the eternal flame at JFK Memorial. But I digress. Team Blue won the water balloon tossing contest, 1 point. For the fourth show of skills, we had to pass a hula hoop from one team member to another without it touching the ground while holding hands. Anthony and I linked paws, and I mentioned that we had never grasped each other so firmly in the 28 years we've known each other, but that sentiment was unappreciated, and Team Blue finished a dismal fourth. No points. Jarek bravely donned another costume as each team had one member put on clown pants, and the other three team members tossed blow-up basketballs into it. With Anthony and I being former hoopsters, Team Blue was again victorious, 1 point. The final event featured a giant tic-tac-toe board. Each team had two members playing the board, with another team member sitting in a chair, with the fourth team member behind the chair with a water balloon the size of an Italian bread. The sitting member of the team that finished last in tic-tac-toe got the wet Italian bread in the back of the head, mafia style. That was me. No points. Team Blue finished the Dottie Olympics with 2 points, a respectable showing in my book. We went inside to the central air and pina coladas from the machine that the Dotties had purchased for the party. They also bought a device that removes pits from cherries that I find remarkable. Rich cooked up some ribs, steak, shrimp, and scallops that were all outstanding. We all agreed the inaugural Dottie 4th of July party and Olympics was an unparalleled success and should continue in perpetuity. Then the kids napped on the couch while I nursed my concussion, and the adults watched grown-ups on the new 98-inch screen. Merry 250th, America. Let the games begin. Joe Fusco Jr. is a Worcester County humorist and stand-up poet. He hosts open mics at the Richard Fox Poetry Series at Root and Press Cafe and the Poetry Extravaganza at the Mill in West Boylston. He teaches Humor 101 at various senior venues in central Massachusetts. And now some Poetry Town for you. This one is titled Stone, written by Ronald C. McGilvray. Long before man's presence on earth, there was stone. Stone, its essence, obdurate, primeval, and in the hearts of some. From labyrinths to mountaintops, jeweled and juiced. An evolution from fiery depths to castles to mayhem. It was Cain's weapon of choice, the first standing stone murder. Today, the sacrificial altar, only a stripped crust soaked with blood. Images hard, unforgiving, vex those with whom we share this rock. The madness of greed destroying the planet is a hunger bizarre. Will we be pardoned for our desecration and devastation of this stone? We shall see. Ronald C. McGilvery is a Kathleen Downey Short Fiction First Place Award winner and has been writing poetry and short stories for an eternity. He is the past editor of the Auburn News. And now, for some things to do. If you're looking for some things to do in and around the Worcester area in the coming days, we've got you covered. First up, In the Woodshed at WCUW. The four-member country and folk group Woodshed from Western Massachusetts came together at open mics and realized they were making connections. Woodshed brings its original songs and three-part harmonies to the front room at WCUW Community Radio on July 18th. Ben Bullock opens. So that is Woodshed, Ben Bullock opening at 7 p.m. July 18th. Doors open at 6:30 p.m., and that's at the front room, WCUW 910 Main Street in Worcester. Tickets are $20 cash or Venmo at the door. A limited number of advance tickets are available at $23.18 and are available at eventbrite.com. Next, Shorty Shorty coming to town. Baltimore rapper Shorty Shorty brings his band of melodic hip-hop back to the Palladium upstairs for another headlining show July 18th as part of his School's Out tour. He's put a lot of new music out since his last stop here. 2025's Breath of Fresh Air and Love Lost albums, this year's full-length More Than Music 3, which features a cameo from Fetty Wap. So fans will have the chance to hear their new favorites live for the first time. So that is Shorty Shorty School's Out Tour, 8 p.m. on July 18th at the Palladium upstairs, 261 Main Street in Worcester. Tickets start at $37.70 and go up from there. You can go to thepalladium.net for more information. Next, set the music to 2000. If you're a fan of pop music from the early aughts, Indian Ranch in Webster has a show you really ought to go to. The Pop 2000 Tour on July 19th will include performances by NSYNC's Chris Kirkpatrick, who also hosts the event, Ryan Cabrera, B.B. Mac, Mark Berry, Christian Burns, and Stephen McNally, O-Town, with Eric Michael Estrada, Dan Miller, Trevor Pennick, and Jacob Underwood, and LFO. So that is Pop 2000 Tour at 1 p.m., with doors opening at 11:30 a.m. on July 19th at the Indian Ranch Amphitheater, 200 Gore Road in Webster. Tickets range from $41.15 to $70.40. You can go to IndianRanch.com for more details. Next, Love Dogs Romp into Spencer. The Love Dogs is a septet from Boston that has been thrilling audiences for more than 20 years, with a powerhouse sound rooted in jump blues, New Orleans R&B, and early rock and roll. The band returns to the Spencer Summer Concert Series on July 19th. So that is the Love Dogs, Spencer Parks and Recreation Commission Summer Concert Series, July 19th from 2 to 5 p.m. at Powder Mill Park, located at the corner of Smithville and Meadow Roads in Spencer. This is a free event. You can go to spencerma.gov for more information. Next, goal! Join the crowd for a big Sunday afternoon, July 19th, as the Worcester Common hosts a free watch party for the FIFA World Cup final, which will be shown on a high-definition big screen on the Oval starting at 3 p.m. No matter which two teams face off, we will see fireworks from France's Kylian Mbappé. Will Argentina and Lionel Messi win it all again? It'll be an exciting day downtown, packed with fans of the beautiful game. So that is the game on Worcester, free watch party on the Worcester Common, July 19th, starting at 3 p.m. That's at the Worcester Common Oval, 455 Main Street in Worcester. That is a free event. For more details, you can check out the Worcester Cultural Coalition on Eventbrite. Next, Ride the Rails of Song. Sultana, the Massachusetts duo of guitarists and singer-songwriters John and Lee Waterman, will perform The Railroad in Song on July 21st at Oxford Free Public Library. The show takes the audience on a tour of songs about trains, the building of the railroad, workers on the railroad, train wrecks, heroes and hobos, along with an accompanying slide presentation. John Waterman's music is influenced by intriguing characters and stories from history. So that is Sultana, The Railroad in Song, July 21st at 6 p.m. at the Oxford Free Library, 339 Main Street in Oxford. It is free, and you can go to oxfordmapubliclibrary.acibetinteractive.com for more details. Next, Slapdragon on Mission at JMAC. Slapdragon began as some musical friends and acquaintances led by bassist and songwriter Scott Mulvihill and singer and songwriter Laura Burns getting together for a possible project in Nashville. Now the band has a mission statement, the title of its recent released first album. Coming to the Brick Box Theater at the JMAC on July 22nd, Slapdragon blends acoustic groove, bluegrass instincts, R&B soul, improvisation, and sharp songwriting. So don't miss Slapdragon, 7:30 p.m., July 22nd at the Brick Box Theater at the Gene McDonough Arts Center, 20 Franklin Street in Worcester. Tickets are $37, and you can go to thehanovertheater.org for more details. And last but certainly not least, All Women, All Bluegrass. The all-women bluegrass band Big Richard exploded onto the Colorado music scene in 2021, featuring driving bluegrass, powerful storytelling, and high-octane musicianship. The band performs July 24th at the Brick Box Theater at the JMAC with mandolinist and guitarist Bonnie Sims, cellist Joy Adams, fiddler Eve Panning, and bassist Hazel Royer. Opening act is Royer's one-man band. So that is Big Richard with Royer's one-man band opening July 24th at 7:30 p.m. at the Brick Box Theater, Gene McDonough Arts Center, 20 Franklin Street in Worcester. Tickets are $37, general admission seating, or $47 for premium seating. You can go to thehanovertheater.org for more details on that. And now we're going to send you over to Catherine for some more articles from Worcester Magazine.
Here we go with more Worcester Magazine for July 17th. Bring on the music with Summer, Sweat, and Seven Hills, article by Jason Greeno. 4 years strong, Silverstein and more rock the Palladium. Summer, Sweat, and Seven Hills, going haywire. If ever there were a cosmic love letter written to the punk and hardcore scene, the city of Worcester and those rare summer days that didn't leave you feeling like you were melting, like one of those Sonic the Hedgehog popsicles, then Saturday afternoon at the Palladium was where it would be written, all thanks to the city's favorite sons in 4 Year Strong. Long before ringing in their 25th anniversary celebration with the commencement of the first run of the Seven Hills Music Festival July 11th, the boys in beards made sure they crafted a day full of top-tier music by way of some of their closest friends. So it must have felt great that after all that preparation, the vibes were noticeably immaculate from the jump. From the moment the day's festivities kicked off around 3:30 p.m., with Chicago's Worry Club taking the stage, each set seemed to come and go with increasingly rapid succession, consistently brandishing a power-packed stretch of time that volleyed a progressively growing crowd between two stages. With Worcester's own hard target getting in on the fun early, in addition to smattering of bands such as Origami Angel, Spaced, and Knucklepuck, it was clear that while not every band on the bill hailed from the Commonwealth, there was a strong through line of love and lore when it came to each band's history with Worcester and 4 Year Strong, to which each band raised a metaphorical glass in a toast to the kinship and mutual respect they found in the city in their own ways. with a loose familiarity of Warped Tour summers of yesteryear. Thankfully, minus the crushing humidity and hot blacktop that made you question whether you were actually moshing on the surface of the sun, the nostalgic foundation of the day created a distinct buzz that only grew louder as each band hit their mark, delivered their best, and once the sun started setting and the scales teetered to the closing half of the night, it was all systems go, and Haywire understood the assignment. As the scorching Boston hardcore monoliths kicked the door down on their set, following their customary sing-along to Sweet Caroline, frontman Austin Sparkman utilized his seemingly endless supply of energy to interact with ravenous fans at the front of the barricade as his grizzled voice blasted from the speakers in what had to have been an indirect effort to shake the foundation of the Turtle Boy Burnside Fountain a few blocks over. Although their lyrics and delivery are largely anything but playful, the band carries a certain air of levity with them that made their set an instant highlight of the day. Having completed the trifecta of playing the upstairs room, the downstairs room, and now the outdoor space of the Palladium all within an impressively short amount of time, Sparkman claims that that will be the last time you see them at the punk and hardcore cathedral. If that's the case, we're glad we were able to witness such a historic beatdown to close things out. As the final note rang out on the main stage, Boston pop punk legends A Loss for Words wasted no time on the festival's second stage on the grounds of Off the Rails, as they brought energy to the capacity before frontman Matty Arsenault even uttered a word. Tearing through a treasure trove of tried-and-true bangers from their catalog of melodic pop-punk croonings that have continued to be part of the scene soundtrack after all these years, the now part-time band brought the full-time heat. Bands reciprocated without missing a single beat and without passing up any chance of a sing-along throughout their quick 30-minute set. While geography has contributed to the band's part-time status, absence certainly does help the heart grow fonder from both sides of the barricade, and it was obvious that the boys were feeling the feels all the way to the end. The main event. With the finish line of the night now in plain sight, Canadian emo freight train Silverstein entered with no time for extended pleasantries and instead offered up a how-do-you-do by blistering the stage with a cavalcade of fan-favorite tracks that span their own quarter-century-old jukebox, exuding their signature explosion of sound at a clip that made frontman Shane Told's expert vocal precision all the more impressive as he belted out hit after hit. It was an unrelenting display of force in all the right ways. As the sun dropped behind the towering smiley face painted overlooking the back lot, classic like Shania Twain's Man, I Feel Like a Woman, the Darude sandstorm kicked in to begin the main event of the evening. A swell of excitement was brought to deafening blast once the lights dropped, and members of the 4 Years Strong led the charge to stage together, just as they have every night for the last 25 years to get things started. As if there was any question whether there would be a fully palpable energy, the band carried a 24-song set to the edge of the stage, and with very obvious connection from both sides of the barricade, as has been the standard for as long as the band has been playing the Palladium, showered the energetic crowd in waves of both lasting teenage angst and more recently forged 40-somethings perspective that both showcased the band's latest milestone and their hunger to keep growing in their musical tastes and approach well beyond the nostalgic waters of the songs that made them such a magnetic band in the first place. They may not have played Go Long Dad, as fans have barked for over the years, but they played a little bit of everything else, or close to it, with the centerpiece being their 2007 album, Rise or Die Trying, being played in full one more time, while throwing in a baker's dozen of additional fan favorites that hopped all over the map and touched on each of their 6 other albums from 2010's Enemy of the World all the way through their heaviest offerings in 2024's Analysis Paralysis. Leading up to the festival, it was no secret that the band was feeling a certain way about wrapping their collective heads around reaching such a monumental marker in their still-bustling career as one of the most well-respected and enduring bands in the scene, and just how much of that they owe to the support that Worcester has shown them over the years. For the fans, though, it was a chance for the older crowd that grew up alongside the band, many of them being from personal friends of the guys, to not only relive their own glory days of cartoonish t-shirt graphics and checkerboard vans, but to also usher in a new generation of fans, as plenty of younger kids were either propped up on their parents' shoulders and singing along to songs almost twice as old as they were, or fully crowd surfing in their way into the fandom. Without a second of a doubt, a glorious full-circle moment was had by many in the back lot of the Palladium, Saturday, July 11th, and at the end of the day, that was kind of the whole point to begin with. Of course, we know this means there won't be a year-end holiday show at Ye Olde Palladium in 2026. For what was offered, though, on the 192nd day of the year, smack dab in the middle of summer, like the old days, it was worth every bead of sweat and whiff of a trolley dog. Not to mention, it felt enough like Christmas in July to give the four-year faithful a chance to recuperate and come back stronger in 2027 for whatever the Doherty High alums come up with next. You're listening to a reading of Worcester Magazine, a production of Audio Journal. We have an article by Sarah Barnacle, Worcester County Wonders, From Disney to Douglas, The Story of Breezy. It was more than 70 years ago when Breezy Picnic Grounds welcomed its first guest to the heart of Blackstone Valley National Heritage Corridor. For three generations, the Forget family has been behind the summer destination. My grandfather started it in 1953 with just six picnic tables down on the water, said Keith Forget. The idea came from his brother-in-law, who had been renting out cabins on another lake as a way to make some money. It was really a come-for-the-day type of experience, and at that point it was really only a little grass area. The grounds changed hands from Keith's grandfather to his father in the late 1960s, early 70s, and they began to expand further with dozens of picnic tables and sprawling grass for the youngest visitors. My father worked for Prudential Insurance and won a trip to Florida, Forget said. He took the whole family, and we went to River Country, Disney's versions of a water park at the time. We absolutely loved it. The family continued to research water slides with a trip to Lake Winnipesaukee, New Hampshire, to visit other series of slides. It really was so early on for water slides, Keith Forget said. My father just believed in it so much and took on such a huge project. A pair of massive water slides were built in 1983 and remained for over 42 years, sending old and young into the warm waters of the Whiten Reservoir. The grounds saw another expansion in 2000 when Keith Forget and his wife Lauren took over management and built the Tunnel Twister, the fastest slide of the three. At the end of the 2025 season, the slides were retired for good, along with their admission price. And while the water slides were an important chapter for the grounds, it was never the entire story. Retiring them at the end of last season was one of the most difficult decisions our family has ever had to make. Like many long-running attractions, they had reached the end of their lifespan. It wasn't a decision we wanted to make, but one we felt was necessary for the future of the property. It was simply going to happen, Keith Forget added, of the slides' retirement. It was very emotional, an incredibly difficult decision. It's our blood, sweat, and tears. This isn't just a business anymore. It's part of you. Since the slides' closure, many visitors have asked if the ground slides could not just simply be replaced. But despite their function, the large attraction is more complex than most realize, adding the hope is to expand some of their water features in the coming years. This year, they've added new floating docks and a handful of hammocks positioned for relaxing in the shallows of the pristine water. There's also a smaller slide for the youngest visitors. The 2026 season has gone back to the original roots of the grounds, welcoming families to spend the day enjoying nature, grilling by the water, making long-lasting memories. Breezy has always been about spending a summer day together. Something about kids running around on the grass, Keith Forget said with a nostalgia in his tone. You know, it's not the concrete or hard surfaces of modern splash pads or pools. It's that barefoot feeling of running through the grass, like when I grew up. Every year we have a lot of the same families come back. You know, they'll tell you they came here with their grandparents, their parents, and now they're here with their kids. There are a lot of deep memories attached to Breezy. So many are attached. The couple are now running the business with the help from their son and daughter. Each family member seemingly does it all, from payroll to cleaning the restrooms. Behind Breezy is simply a family who has devoted generations of their lives to caring for this special place. Everything we do throughout the year is with one goal in mind, that when families arrive, they find a beautiful, clean, safe, and welcoming place where they can simply relax and enjoy their day together. Aside from the nostalgic old-school summer fun, the water is crystal clear. People talk about being able to see their toes in 5 feet of water. It's pretty incredible. Unlike many local swimming spots in central Massachusetts, Breezy has yet to see an algae bloom or bacterial outbreak such as E. coli during its nearly 75-year history. These naturally occurring blooms are caused by cyanobacteria and can be harmful to people and animals, typically prompting the closure of swimming areas. In 2025, more than 7,500 water samples were collected from freshwater beaches across the state. Nearly 4% of freshwater beaches reported exceeding statewide bacterial water quality standards, which prompted closures. Among the 568 locations, 138 had at least one bacterial exceedance. Despite these numbers, state officials report overall both 2024 and 2025 revealed a decline in closures due to both algae blooms and other bacterial elements. The water here is tested every week, Lauren Forget said. It's so clean, you can drink it. And now for today's cover story.
You are listening to Worcester Magazine, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. And now it's time for this week's cover story, Hazards at Home. Worcester Film explores risks facing firefighters, including at the stations, written by Richard Duckett. The leading cause of line-of-duty deaths for firefighters is not from fires, although in Worcester, there has certainly been terrible tragedy in that regard, such as the December 3, 1999, Worcester Cold Storage and Warehouse Company fire, which took the lives of 6 firefighters. And while cardiovascular events from stress can definitely be a killer, that is not the leading cause either. Rather, cancer is the biggest risk for firefighters, and by a staggering margin. According to the International Association of Firefighters, nearly 80% of member line-of-duty deaths in 2025 were due to occupational cancer. Cancer is a pandemic sweeping through the fire service, said award-winning Worcester-born filmmaker, writer, and actor Tommy J. Dwyer, who comes from a well-known local family of firefighters. A lot of it is preventable, he noted. Preventable in the fire service's own house, namely its firehouses. Dwyer, who now lives in Paxton, hopes to bring the hidden challenges facing today's firefighters to light as the director of the documentary Burning Down the House, which has its world premiere on August 6 at the Hanover Theater and Conservatory for the Performing Arts at 2 Southbridge Street in Worcester. In many instances, preventative steps aren't being taken as firefighters across the country work and sleep at old firehouses where toxic gear, breathe bad fumes, and dodge asbestos hanging down from the firehouse ceiling and water on the floors. With the cancer rates, part of it we probably can't do a lot about. Part of it we can do a lot about, Dwyer said. We look at the deteriorating conditions of firehouses across the country, with 3 in Massachusetts serving as examples, Dwyer said. They include Worcester's South Division Fire Station at 180 Southbridge Street, and also Fall River Fire Department Central Station, known as the Big House, and Fire Station 1 in Westwood. Dwyer had unprecedented access last summer, although a number of other municipalities said no to him visiting, and interviewed firefighters where they work and live. Meanwhile, firefighters from across the eastern seaboard also sent him photos and videos from their firehouses as word got out that the film was being made. 42% of firehouses in the country are more than 40 years old, with little in the way of upgrades to counter health hazards. They didn't know the health hazards then. We know now. They're still not doing anything, Dwyer said. Burning Down the House is presented in partnership with the Last Call Foundation, Greatest Graham Productions, Hollywood Film Group, Lean Into Production, and others. The film is produced by John Kia with James J. Labonte, Director of Photography, and music by Sasha Chabin. The Last Call Foundation was formed in memory of fallen Boston firefighter Michael Kennedy with a mission to improve the health and wellness of firefighters nationwide through research and fundraising. This film was never about buildings, said Dwyer. It's about the people inside them. It's about firefighters who continue to show up for their communities despite the sacrifices that come with the job. I wanted to tell the real story about what the real men and women face on the front lines. Just 2 days after the interview for this story, the firefighting community was grieving the loss of a third-generation firefighter who was a strong voice in awareness of occupational cancer. Patrick J. P.J. Roy, age 45, of Fitchburg, died July 8th. Dwyer grew up near Webster Square and graduated from Worcester State University. His family of firefighters includes his father and uncles and cousins. After getting into acting and needing to change his name because there was already a Tommy Dwyer in the acting profession, Dwyer purposefully added J as his middle name in honor of a James F. J. Lyons III, one of the firefighters who died in the Worcester Cold Storage and Warehouse Company fire, and someone he knew well. Dwyer followed a call that has included acting and filmmaking, but has also led him back to a key part of his identity with Burning Down the House. This journey has taken me to a different direction to tell the story of the men and women, he said. He's been all in. It's something close to my heart from the very beginning, something I've given my all to. Dwyer's family have had distinguished service as firefighters, but Dwyer has also seen the cost in terms of health. His father had 2 heart attacks and cancer before he was 70, and a firefighter uncle battled cancer and a heart attack before he was 65. His father's cousin, Worcester Fire Department District Chief Cliff DeCourcy, essentially died on the job of idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis 7 days after he retired. His lungs were like cement, Dwyer said. Growing up, Dwyer can remember his father's firefighter gear hanging in the house. Now, firefighters across the country, including Worcester, have filed ongoing federal lawsuits alleging that high concentrations of PFAS in manufacturing gear led to cancer and other medical problems. Dwyer said that children of firefighters are 70% more likely to die of cancer. The Last Call Foundation, which is based in Massachusetts, contacted Dwyer about possibly making a documentary. The Last Call Foundation found out there was a filmmaker from Worcester from a firefighter family, Dwyer recalled. The original idea was that Dwyer would make a 15-minute documentary short. However, as things were getting underway, I said, I'm not going to ask for additional funds, but said, this has to be a full-length film. An important first step was to approach municipalities for permission to visit firehouses and film and conduct interviews. That was a journey in and of itself, Dwyer said. Some were willing. A lot of them did not want us to come in, which, to me, tells a story. Worcester was willing. I'm proud of the city. Worcester, Fall River, and Westwood represent 3 different scenarios, 3 different geopolitical levels of wealth, and all the same outcome regardless, Dwyer said. The common outcome is the conditions are hard and unlivable. I don't think they'd be allowed in other public sector buildings. Firehouses are where firefighters are stationed during long shifts, eating and sleeping in them while not working, although ready for an alarm that could come in at any minute. This is their home. This is where they live, Dwyer said. Dwyer started filming in early summer 2025, beginning with Worcester South Division Fire Station. We basically embedded with them. We see every nook and cranny of the firehouse, every in and out. We see their living rooms, bathrooms, showers, Dwyer said. Many of the people at Worcester South Division Fire Station knew Dwyer from his family ties, so we had an in with them right away. But everywhere the men and women are super welcoming, he said. Dwyer said he approached the film as wanting to shine a light on the issue, posing questions such as, who protects those who protect us? When it came to interviews, Dwyer said firefighters are so used to advocating for others, they're not used to advocating for themselves. One comment about conditions might be, well, you know, it is what it is. I think there's definitely a mindset, Dwyer said. Asked if some firefighters were afraid to speak out, Dwyer said, for sure, they're not used to advocating. For me, I wanted to open up discussion. Dwyer noted that firefighters are almost universally loved, but they get forgotten about on a day-to-day basis. In Fall River, part of a ceiling was hanging down from the fire station. In Westwood, the fire station was closed in the spring of this year, and a temporary structure was built after the growing hole was noticed in the apparatus floor. Westwood is an affluent community, but voters have twice defeated a proposal to build a new fire station. The town supports the measure, but voters have said otherwise, Dwyer noted. Instead of a thumbs up for their service, firefighters would prefer a vote when the budgetary heat is on for support and staffing. It's putting your vote where your mouth is, Dwyer said. There has been good news since the filming finished. On June 1st, ground was broken on a new South Division fire station in Worcester that is expected to be operational in 2027. The current fire station dates back to 1950. Burning Down the House is Dwyer's first time directing a documentary. Dwyer's short film, Solace, was an award winner last year at the online Top Shorts Film Festival. Solace won Best Thriller, and Dwyer won Best Director and Best Actor. The film was part of an ongoing collaboration between Dwyer's Greatest Grand Productions and Kia's Hollywood Film Group. They will also combine a full-length horror feature film anthology written and directed by Dwyer titled The Hours That Keep Us. Meanwhile, Dwyer has plans for another documentary about firefighters. In taking on a documentary, Dwyer said his style leans into his experience with feature films by imbuing Burning Down the House with an underlying narrative, getting award-winning French composer Chabin to write music that is played by a 52-piece orchestra also gives Burning Down the House a different feel than a regular documentary, Dwyer said. Half the proceeds will benefit the Last Call Foundation, and everyone involved in the film is hoping it gets national attention. The world premiere of Burning Down the House is at 7:30 p.m. August 6th at the Hanover Theater, and it promises to be a gala occasion. A limited number of VIP tickets are available for $132 and include a red carpet VIP entrance, access to the VIP after party, a photo opportunity with Dwyer, an exclusive signed poster, and a VIP gift bag. We're excited about the premiere, Dwyer said. Burning Down the House is an opportunity to raise awareness about the challenges facing the fire service today. I hope the fire departments get the support they deserve, he said. And that concludes this week's cover story for Worcester Magazine. Now we send you back over to Catherine for some more articles.
Worcester Walks takes us to the great outdoors. Bearsden Forest Conservation Area travels through time. There's a beautiful picture of a wooded area with large rocks, beautiful trees, and foliage. As a woodlands walker, I love any place that gives you a sense of complete removal from everything unrelated to the feeling of a primordial forest, and Beardsden Forest Conservation Area in Athol is just such a place. With an intricate network of trails weaving through 1,568 acres, Beardsden offers views of Miller's River and the hidden mountainous nature of central Massachusetts, a restoration in recent years of Round Top Vista with funds including from the Mass Recreational Trails Grant and local conservation commission, affords a chance to clip Mounts Wachusett, Wahtatip, and Monadnock. The vista is accessible from the main parking lot. The town of Athol notes it's a strenuous climb to the summit, which at 1,278 feet marks the town's second highest hill. But if it's a great view you want, it might just be worth it. Other trails lead to the former Newton Reservoir or Duck Pond, to Haven for waterfowl, to the Oxbow, and to the majestic wetland Thousand Acre Swamp. If you're a fly fisherman, as was my late husband Lawrence Carradini, Beardsden offers a special catch-and-release section of Miller's River. Remember, we're talking about fish, not kids, so plan accordingly. Cabin lodging for a longer stay is also available. Along the way, a visitor will find those secretive New England stone walls holding clues to an earlier time and earlier peoples. A bit of conservation history. Since the 1970s, Beardsden has provided a protected forest reserve from South Royalston and Phillipston to Athol along part of the Miller's River. In all, Beardsden comprises 14 parcels under the auspices of the Athol Conservation Commission. For this projection project, the Athol Conservation Commission, under Commission Chair Bob Muzzy, undertook a forest stewardship plan developed in 2011. The plan was prepared by licensed forester Michael Mowry, with funding assistance from the Department of Conservation and Recreation. I stopped by on a late spring day. A hint of rain spread over the region. Quiet prevailed, apart from the occasional insect buzzing past and the chorus of birdsong signaling the onset of early evening. In such places, I think about the slow, crushing movement of glaciers across the region that shaped our hill and mountains, rocky ledges and glorious hills for climbing and exploring. Beardsden will provide a snapshot of all that and more. Well, there, give pause to think of Elwin Earl Bacon, whose memory is honored with a granite memorial. Athol native, founder of the New England Equestrian Center and the Vietnam Veterans of America chapter of Athol, and longtime constable and president for the Athol Conservation Area. Quietly, Bacon's legacy persists. Beardsden Forest Conservation Area is located on Beardsden Road in Athol, and there's free parking available. Margaret Smith contributes the Last Call column, David Bailey, author and educator. In 1953, in the industrial city of Hamilton, Ontario, a 9-year-old boy's life ends brutally in the hands of a sociopathic killer, and his body remains lost for 2 decades until 1974, when discovered by contractors rerouting a pipe. Shocked at first, the public moves on quickly from the terrible news, all except for a lonely boy, Scott Campbell, who lives in the same building where the remains were found. Struggling with a disorder known as selective mutism, neglected by a mother with her own battles with mental illness, Scott has no friends, until one day in the building's furnace room, Scott encounters a child's shadow, which follows him faithfully through a string of foster homes to adulthood. By 1987, Scott, a street artist, makes strange sculptures from found objects and simply leaves them in odd and obscure places around the city. Scott's caseworker, Simon, is running out of options for his charge. What's more, Scott, an indigenous first person with ties to the Six Nations of the Grand River, is conflicted by his work with the government-funded Children's Aid Society. Thus, Hamilton provides the crucible of dark inspiration for Little Bones, published in 2024, and the second of author David Bailey's trilogy, Sons of the Hammer. The first book, What We Salvage, was published in 2015 with its Canadian launch at This Ain't Hollywood, a punk bar in Hamilton, and a familiar place in Bailey's own life. The U.S. launch took place the same year in ReaderCon, a horror literature convention held in Burlington. As a son of Hamilton, nicknamed the Hammer, Bailey found a rich reservoir of experiences and impressions for stories that would eventually become part of his trilogy, for which a third book, Attrition, has been written. A search for a publisher is in the works. Together, the three books comprise a simultaneous trilogy and don't have to be read chronologically or together to be understood. Bailey is also a frequent guest at horror and science fiction film and literature conventions, including as a panelist. Upcoming appearances include NECON, a horror convention, July 16th to the 19th at St. Elmsham College in Manchester, New Hampshire, and Necronomicon Providence, a horror convention honoring author and Providence native H.P. Lovecraft, set for August 13th to the 16th in Providence, Rhode Island. For many years, Bailey has made his home in Worcester and serves as head of the English department at Worcester Academy. But Hamilton lives in his heart, in his words. Bailey recently spoke about his passion for writing and for fostering the skills of writing and reading in young learners. How and when did your relationship with writing actually begin? I'm Canadian. I moved down here in 96, so I moved from Hamilton, Ontario, also known as The Hammer, in 1996 to teach, which I still do. I teach at Worcester Academy. I chair the English department. We're planning a writer's festival in the spring. I got homesick. I got homesick for Hamilton, which is a big steel city of 500,000 people at the terminal of Lake Ontario. So I started writing these things. What We Salvage is about the punk scene in the 1980s, which I was part of, and it just went from there. Wait, I think I'm writing a novel. And I wrote the novel. Little Bones and Attrition are also part of what I call a trilogy. The major characters in one are minors in the other. What made you delve into telling the story? Well, my primary drive was homesickness. I just missed home. It was a way of falling in love with the city of Hamilton all over again and the punk scene of the 80s. It was a rich and powerful, formulative time. I played in a couple of punk bands myself. It was just a way of reconnecting with friends, especially with my first book launch, which took place, of all places, in a punk club called This Ain't Hollywood. I received a fair bit of hate mail from white supremacist groups. I did a newspaper article, radio interview, and then the white supremacists decided to send me some hate mail. They sent a rep to the book launch. He looked like he was put together at a John Deere tractor plant. The guy was huge. I think he thought he was going to break up a bunch of nerdy, oversensitive book readers or something. A friend of mine took over and said, "No, my pig, my farm, I'll do it. You see where you are, right? Take off that stupid jacket and get a beer and try to talk to some people and figure out the roots of this thing, or else you're out the door safely." And to his credit, he stayed. I think we had a convert by the end of the night. So all's well that ends well. When you send a book out into the world, it takes on whatever life it's going to take. Yeah, of course, that's for any writer. You're not there to explain anything for context. When the reader also brings life experience, or lack thereof, they can only understand what you understand. We tend to look for connection in characters. We tend to gravitate toward experiences that echo our own. And so what I write is not for everybody. It's industrial. It's tough. It's gritty. I try to do it in as poetic a form as I can. My influences are Arundhati Roy, Margaret Atwood, William Faulkner. Those are a great range of writers, but one thing they have in common is poetic prose. I tend to be attracted to that. You work at Worcester Academy. What are the challenges, and what gives you the most joy as an educator and department head? At the institution, we keep our classes small. We're able to give our kids really, really direct one-on-one instruction, especially writing and improving writing. My wife is a public school teacher, so I sympathize with my public school peers. It's hard with 25, 26 kids. How many essays can you assign? In my classes, there are more drafts and feedback, and that makes for better writers, kids who are more aware of syntax and diction, other things, and they're into making good sequences of writing structure and things like that. We can also go into deep analysis of what we teach, a deep dive into just about everything, prose, plays, nonfiction. So forming those personal connections to kids, the one-on-one connections, is probably the most rewarding. The best, I think, is actually seeing them grow, and at the end of the year, handing the first essay, and then at the end of the year, the last essay. Look at that growth. Inspire them to read as much as possible. Okay, we have time for a few things to do this week. All Women, All Bluegrass, the all-women bluegrass band Big Richard, exploded onto the Colorado music scene in 2021, featuring driving bluegrass, powerful storytelling, and high-octane musicianship. The band performs July 24th at the Brick Box Theater at the JMAC with mandolinist and guitarist Bonnie Sims, cellist Joy Adams, fiddler Eve Panning, bassist Hazel Royer. 7:30 p.m. July 24th at the Brick Box Theater, Jean McDonough Arts Center on Franklin Street. And tickets are $37 for general admission, $47 for premium seating. Set the music to 2000. If you're a fan of pop music from the early aughts, Indian Ranch in Webster has a show you really ought to go to. The Pop 2000 Tour on July 19th will include performances by NSYNC's Chris Kirkpatrick, Ryan Cabrera of B.B. Mac, O-Town, Estrada, Dan Miller, Trevor Penick, and Jacob Underwood, LFO, Pop 2000 Tour. It's at 1 p.m. The doors open at 11:30 a.m. at the Indian Ranch Amphitheater on Gore Road in Webster. The fee there is $41.15 to $70.40. Finally, join the crowd for a big Sunday afternoon, July 19th, as the Worcester Common hosts a free watch party for the FIFA World Cup Final, which will be shown on a high-definition big screen on the Oval starting at 3 p.m. Will Argentina and Lionel Messi win it all again? It'll be an exciting day downtown, packed with fans of the beautiful game. The game on Worcester, it's a free watch party on the Worcester Common. Starts at 3 p.m. at the Worcester Common on Main Street, and this event is free. You have been listening to a reading of Worcester Magazine, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Catherine Thornton, reading with Julie Standrovich. Thank you for listening.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. What's going on in your town is important to you. Meetings that decide your taxes, changes in laws in your community, plans for new housing and businesses, and news about schools are all vital for you to know. Here on Audio Journal, we read many local community newspapers each week. In addition to the news of your community and area, you'll also hear about special events, stories about your neighbors, their businesses, their activities, and more. Stay in touch with your community on Audio Journal, broadcasting to print-impaired residents of Central Massachusetts. You say you love a good book, that you enjoy listening to a good story that piques your interest, which challenges your imagination to explore places where it has never gone before? If so, then Audio Journal's Backyard Bookshelf is for you. Backyard Bookshelf is Audio Journal's award-winning book reading program that always has a local flavor, featuring books about New England, as well as books written by local authors or native New Englanders, be it fiction or nonfiction. So join us, won't you? Just tune in every Friday at 4 p.m. and enjoy. That's Backyard Bookshelf, a production of Audio Journal.